Bill Ron and I worked together a little bit on this presentation and tried to include some of his thoughts and ideas. But the idea was that many of you and myself and others, we've collected lots and lots of data from these sensors, and we're getting to the point now of we think there's a lot more information there that we can extract out if we think about what it is and what we might want to do with it. So I'm going to get on my pedestal here for a minute and just point out that there's some attributes that go with each one of these sensor systems. Each one is a bit on the unique side, and as long as you keep that in mind when you start to looking at it, I think we have a good shot at and getting a good interpretation. And just for example, the footprints, for example, they're considerably different. You can see the crop circle, the green seeker, and the one that the crop spec one is similar to the Yara one in Europe. The effective distance, or what I call perspective, as you change the distance between the sensor and the target. The crop circle one, the target's going to, or the footprint's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Green seeker, pretty much collimated. It gets a little wider as you get further away. And you can imagine what happens with the crop spec. What's the range of distances? They're different. It's based on their optics, their design, the electronics, a number of things like this. How about the wave bands? Well, they're different also. You've heard people talk about which ones and why they work and where you would use one versus the other one. There's even some handheld versions now of these things. So one of these, it's available. You can look at it downstairs called RapidScan, but it's a way of taking some of this, the same kind of technologies that a farmer might have, but it's now in a handheld version. There's one called the pocket sensor. This comes out of Oklahoma State. Dave Franson made a good point here, and some of you have tried to use a green seeker, a chlorophyll meter, a SPAD meter on wheat. Well, that doesn't make you very attuned to that. You don't like that because your back won't handle it. And the chiropractors love this one, but anyway, I think that's the situation of perhaps there are entities that could use something like that. So now going on, when you start to take these crop canopy sensors and relate them to something else that a farmer might have, such as yield, we've got a difference in frequency or data collection here. And so there's an opportunity then to start to put things together. I'll give you an example. At 4.5 miles an hour, these things report back at about 10 hertz. So now we're talking maybe 8 inches. Perhaps that's one or two plants, three plants, no plants, something like that. If you drive faster, of course, you're going to get more plants and then follow suit. With a combine header, every second you're perhaps getting a rectangle that's a couple meters wide or wide by who knows how long it is, 30 feet, something like this. So we're trying to put together apples and oranges. So just be careful. That's the point there. The other situation is that as we start to extract data, most of our calibrations have come from small plot research. We like to do that. We started with nitrogen rates, SPAD meters, and sensors and this whole thing. So we had discrete variables out there. And yet now we've come to learn, as you put them into high nitrogen reference strips or ramped reference strips, anything like this, we have effects with mineralization. We have effect with nitrogen losses. So we've got a real hodgepodge now of a spatial variability that's out there confounding these relationships we'd like to have with our sensors. This is nothing new to you, but it's a fact of life. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is that these sensors aren't made to do everything. They're made to monitor living biomass, And tell us something about chlorophyll content. What they can't do is to tell us how much extra nitrogen is in the system. They just won't do that. And we shouldn't expect them to do that. So what some folks have done is to say, well, we're going to put more nitrogen treatments out there in hopes that we find a nice range, and we fully expect that there will be some that have too much. But this is how we're going to work to calibrate these stinkers. So once you've got your SPAD meter, your sensor data, you've got a whole cadre of other kinds of data that you might want to compare this with. SPAD meters, leaf area index, you name it, it's all out there. And so each one of those has its own attributes and uncertainties. And so it's another bit of a challenge. So just be prepared to ask a lot of questions about these relationships. One of the other ones is that we have to keep in mind our eyes see things that these sensors cannot see. They have a footprint, and they're averaging everything within that footprint. Even as they move along, they may take data at 40,000 cycles a second, but that's an average. And our eyes can see things like striations and positions on the leaves where the nitrogen or other kinds of stresses show themselves. They may manifest themselves as a chlorophyll, but to our eyes, they tell us something else. So now we're going to get to this business of extracting data. I've stepped back off the pulpit here. And so some of the ways that folks have started to extract data from these sensors, the folks in Missouri have had reasonable luck using the average type data from, let's say, a farmer's reference strip. The Greenseeker folks, they use a 3-second running average. And the ag leader people, Optrix people, they developed the histogram system. There's reasons for each one to use these different systems, but what I wanted to do is to show you then on a sample set of data where they all fit together. This is some data we collected from Mexico in 2010. This strip is corn at V5. We were driving about 6 kilometers per hour, about 4 miles per hour, and it represents about 10 minutes worth of data as you drive through the field. So this is where the 3-second running average would pick it out. There's the 95 percentile, which comes from the histogram, and this is the average. How you put this together in your algorithm may affect the results. How you do it, just to show you an example that there's a difference, would also say that there's probably a lot more information in this little set of figures, because you might want to know what happened midway through the field, what's different in the lower end of the field because it seems to have lower sensor readings. It's a reason to go out and explore. A little bit more about the histogram, because that's probably the one that's hardest to visualize, but it's within Excel, so it's very easy to construct this with anybody's data set. But it's a frequency distribution, and the pink line represents just a cumulative percentile. So what we've done is, over time, we've looked at many, many of these things, and what we find is that the 95 percentile is very close to what I call happy corn. That's a sort of a kind of a crude term, but I call it happy corn. And that also represents a sufficiency index of 1. A sufficiency index of 1. That goes back to the SPAD meter days when we developed the protocol for how to use that on corn. What we've learned also is that at about the 20 percentile level, this is a sufficiency index of 0.7. You say, what's that mean? Well, what we're finding is that this delta SI, the value between a sufficiency index of 1 and 0.7, this is the area that we have the greatest opportunity to fix and bring the system up to full productivity. If you go below about a sufficiency index of 0.7, there's probably something else going on out there that is going to inhibit or prohibit us from making full recovery. Maybe it's population. Maybe it's something else in the field that's worth going after that you could potentially fix. So that's the idea with the histogram. This is what's now built into the Ag Leader system using the optic sensors. Several papers downstairs in the poster session talk about fertilizing by the plant. If we've got these sensors that read 40,000 cycles per second and all this kind of stuff and report back to us every 8 inches, we ought to be able to monitor each plant. Well, I've taken an example here of just a run-of-the-mill stretch of row. I'm going to superimpose on there now at 4.5 miles an hour every tenth of a second now. So this is 10 hertz data. So this is about what the sensor is going to see with each data that it records, GPS coordinates as well as what's going on. I have real trouble saying that I'm going to be able to identify what a plant is doing out there. The overlapping leaves, there's just a lot of different things, and depending on where that tenth of a second starts and stops, you could be getting different things. So the rule of thumb is that to really get at each individual plant, you need between 5 and 10 times more samples taken. So you need to jack the speed up of your sampling system or drive a hell of a lot slower, one or the other. And that isn't going to happen. So the paper downstairs, the poster, said they tried to fertilize based on individual plant performance. And the results, I think, said inconclusive. So you might go down and take a look at it. Anyway, what I wanted to point out now is two examples of extracting data and using it. The first one comes from a situation. We had a graduate student who was interested in determining how many sensors you need to put across a boom. How many do you need? And so we had 4 sensors. He ran them up and down 24 rows, down and back, collected all the sensor data. When it came in, this is what it showed. And what I've done, folks, is this was an 8-row farmer, and what I've done is grouped them into 8-row pairings for you. To my surprise, this is the combination now. As he turned around at the ends, the combinations of starting to play detective and figuring out what was going on. Well, it's easy to count the plants. That didn't tell us anything. Get out the SPAD meter, and that didn't tell us anything either. So take leaf samples, send them off to the lab. Thought, must be starter fertilizer problems. In fact, some of the results came back just the opposite of what we would expect. Counted the number of rows of kernels at harvest. Didn't tell me anything. So it's time to get out the plot combine one row at a time. Harvest this stinker. We did not have a yield monitor for each row, but we weighed each row at the end. This is the information we obtained. This is the yield. Apologize for it not being in metric. But this is the average now for those 8-row sections. Quite a bit of difference out there. We still didn't understand the full situation and probably won't for a while, but it's probably a combination of when the farmer harvests, he has an 8-row combine, he uses a grain cart, and perhaps there's something else going on. This is what, if you look at the 8-row combinations, something going on with row 1 and row 5 for sure. Maybe it's because when he puts his anhydrous ammonia on, he splits the outside knives. One gets more, one gets less. Who knows? But in a relative sense, folks, there's a 20% difference between what's happening between row 8 and many of the other rows. 10 to 20% difference. Is that worth going after? We wouldn't have seen this and couldn't see this from the aircraft. We had an aerial photo that showed it was uniform. So, a potential use for these sensors, identifying problems that we can't see. Is it perfect? No. This is the chlorophyll information, relative yield, but there's something there. Now, the other example comes from the opposite side of the situation, where there was a complete data set out there, and from that, the authors extracted a portion of it to illustrate their point. This is published. They calculated a response index, which is basically the reference yield divided by whatever treatment yield it is. They chose to use the check plot, the zero nitrogen rate, and their response index then is the maximum yield divided by the check plot yield. So this is the range of values they get. And you look at that data and you'd say, there's nothing there. Just a hodgepodge. They had information like this for wheat, and this is a long-term study now. So they had two wheat studies and this study, and it provided similar information. Conclusion was that you need to use yield and this nitrogen responsiveness to fertilizer as you develop and build a nitrogen fertilizer recommendation. So that's the data they started with. But if you look at all the data, you look at the data for the other nitrogen rates, you start to say, well, there's certainly a year effect. That's what's happening here. The yields are different from year to year, but perhaps within a year, there might be something going on. So there might be something going on. And what I did was plotted it differently. I said, let's take those same years, and we're going to talk about relative yield now. But you see that the check plot yields are all over the place. They're related to mineralization, rainfall patterns. This was irrigated, but nonetheless, there's mineralization and other plant growth factors. If you look at the relative yield, there is a trend. Not a big trend, but certainly the reference or the check plot is greatly different. I would question whether the range of nitrogen rates here is enough to really make that kind of conclusion. And secondly, these long-term check plot yields are, like Dave says, no farmer's going to do it. They're nice to know and tell us something about mineralization, but no farmer's going to do this sort of thing. And so the conclusion is that this relative yield is really, it's correlated, it's affected by year to a great extent. To help us verify this, I went to another long-term irrigated corn study that involved corn and soybeans. In a rotation, it had four hybrids and more replications, more nitrogen rates. And this is the kind of relationship we get. Same way that the other study did, relative yield versus yield. And in this case, I would say that there's clearly a relationship going on here, and that would suggest that maybe we don't need yield and this yield response in our nitrogen algorithms. What we're really trying to do with these sensors or any kind of imagery is to develop a relationship now between what's happening with the vegetation, the crop vigor at various growth stages, and what we haul off the field. That's what we're really after. And so we tried to do that with some data from 2009, one of our studies, irrigated corn. And what we did was we plotted this sufficiency index, which is, I think it's on there. Basically, this goes back to the chlorophyll meter days again, where we take the treatment value and divide it by, in this case, a high nitrogen rate, or the reference. That's a good relationship. And so that's what we're relying on of using that information during the growing season to predict it to the end of the year. So I guess I would say that this kind of relationship can be very useful when it comes time to build these algorithms. In conclusions, they're pretty simple, but always think about the attributes that go along with your sensors, the corollary information that you want to compare it to, or why you're using the sensors. Ask lots of questions. When you go to the field, look for the good and look for the bad parts of the field. Try to understand why they're the way they are. And finally, look for other pieces of information. Several of the speakers have said, well, we had satellite information, we had this or that. I'm going to show you some examples now. This is a three-year-old baseball diamond, Lincoln, Nebraska, aerial photograph. Looks pretty good. We ran the sensors over this. Start to ask questions. You can start to see maybe where the players spent a lot of time, what might be happening out there, and the kinds of things that you could see 2 or 3 weeks then before they would be visible to the human eye. A lot of that is driven by soil background, soil organic matter properties, things like that, drainage, you name it. But that can be obtained with satellite imagery or aerial photography. Another advantage of photography is that in this figure, you'll see the area up here had hail damage. You wouldn't want to have your studies in that kind of area, but you'll see a bunch of blocky stuff over here. That's weed control problems, sprayer problems, more nightmares. Speaking of nightmares, this poor guy's center pivot irrigation system was causing him major problems. It has a tail or an end unit on it, so that when that end unit swings out and applies extra water, tries to apply extra water, it doesn't get it out there. It distributes that same amount of water over a much larger area. And so you'd hate to have a strip trial in that kind of field. Finally, this is a very recent type picture. Some of you may have access to thermal infrared technologies. This is from an irrigated cornfield in Kansas. But you can see the blue colors are the cool ones. The irrigation system is going around, and you can see right where it stops. But you see some strange patterns going around where there's excess water, starting and stopping problems. Those are opportunities. Sensors might pick these up, but in general, in total, I think these are opportunities for precision agriculture. So with that, I'll say thank you. I'll entertain one question if there's any.